Thank you, Ken. I too had problems getting here, so I think we're even. We left, well, I won't go into detail, but we were in the storm. And then I get up here and I try to take some notes, and my pen quit writing. That's a serious matter. So, you know, whose side are the forces of nature on? I don't know. I would like to also begin by thanking the Christian Union and the Philosophical Society of Edinburgh University, and both Josh and Georgie. I appreciate this opportunity. Beautiful venue. Nice to be with you. Flew into town today. Have to leave tomorrow, but I'm very happy to be with you this evening. I'm defending the view that you just heard was a fairy tale, but that's okay. Ken's a good guy. We've talked on the phone. We had a little time before. I told him, I said, if we were neighbors, we would probably get together during a football game, and we'd have a lot of chats. I think we should. I think this thing is wonderful, a discussion like this. Let me first begin by telling you some things I am not going to try to do, or so you're clear about my position, things I am not defending. Okay? First of all, I do not argue that Christianity is vindicated by faith and we should all believe. I am interested in data, historical data, to be exact, other kinds. Secondly, I will not argue tonight, the Bible tells me so. My beliefs about the Bible aside, I will not assume inspiration of the Bible, biblical reliability, or anything of the sort. I'm going to make an argument for the resurrection that borrows sources and data from critics, agnostics, atheists, who are writing today. The biggest named scholars writing today of those mindsets, I'm going to use their data. At no point will I assume, I mean, of course I'm willing to talk about the Bible, and I assume Ken will too. But I think what I'm saying is, I'm referring to the Bible as an ancient document. The way you might ask a question about Shakespeare or Homer or somebody else, Suetonius, Tacitus, what do we know about data? Thirdly, I do not believe that things are true because scholars say so. I should say it this way. I don't think things are true just because scholars say so. But I think it's very, very important that we understand the scholarly lay of the land for this reason. Not because scholarship proves anything, but because if scholars from the left, right, and center agree on something, they probably agree for good reasons. There are probably reasons behind their agreement. But I don't think citing scholars solves the issue. I'm not going to argue tonight, it might surprise some of you, I'm not going to argue tonight that the resurrection is a miracle. I'm going to argue that the resurrection is an event that occurred in history. A man named Jesus of Nazareth died, and a man named Jesus of Nazareth was later seen. And that would constitute resurrection, to appear after a real death. So that's my argument. Because I'm giving deference to David Hume here, we're in his city, and he says a miracle is an act of God that breaks the laws of nature, and that's just part of a discussion I'm not going to be able to get into. Those are some thoughts up front. What I do want to say is, let me go back to this earlier topic. I want to argue that we have data for the resurrection, and I'm going to give an argument here in just a moment for the resurrection, and I'm going to limit my facts almost totally to folks with whom I have huge disagreements. I'm going to limit my survey to, as I said, atheist, agnostic, and skeptical New Testament scholars or theologians. Because once again, I'll repeat the principle. I'll go in reverse order. There's two principles here. The second one is, I build a lot on where scholarship is. Not because that in itself proves anything, but because I think scholarship is there for a reason. And when believers and unbelievers agree about something, it's usually because there are reasons. It's usually because there are data. Okay. So if you ask a Christian, if you said, here's the New Testament, and you want to talk about this man, Jesus, and the Christian says, yes. And he said, but the man's in the book. Yep. I don't believe the book, so I don't believe the man. That's a thoughtful objection. And I'm going to take about that same approach tonight because, as I said, I'm not going to assume either inspiration or reliability? But if you ask the average Christian that question, they're going to say something like this. Well, if we want to talk about the resurrection of Jesus, we need to take a look at the Gospels of Mark, in normal order. Mark, Matthew, Luke, and John. And these Gospels are usually strewn along a timeline from about 65 to 95 A.D. For example, the well-known skeptical scholar G.A. Wells, who from London area, argues that all of these Gospels are written before 120 A.D. Okay, that's a typical approach, but I think the best approach to argue for the resurrection is to use the writings of the Apostle Paul for this reason. Today, Paul is the critic's darling, you might say. Critics from the opposite side of the spectrum that I'm on will say Paul is the critic's darling. Why? Well, Michael Martin, atheistic professor of philosophy in the U.S., wrote a book called The Case Against Christianity, says this. Paul's testimony is the only eyewitness testimony we have for a resurrection appearance of Jesus. Okay, so I can either say, well, wait a minute, how about the Gospels? Or I can say, I'll take Paul and move with him. And just to start, I'm going to take Paul. Now, probably the best-known critic in our country, the best-known skeptic in our country, is an agnostic scholar, and his name is Bart Ehrman. He's written a number of books. Generally, he's published by Oxford University Press, so there's a little tie across the ocean. And Bart talks about the undisputed epistles of Paul, as almost every New Testament scholar does. And they will generally label seven books with that title. Bart would say Romans, 1 and 2 Corinthians, Galatians, Philippians, 1 Thessalonians, Philemon. And I'll just note in passing, G.A. Wells gives the exact same list with Colossians added. So G.A. Wells has eight epistles. These are dated between 50, sometimes scholars go back as early as 48, but these are dated from 50 to 60 A.D. G.A. Wells dates them from 50 to 60 A.D. So I'm using G.A. Wells, and I'm using Bart Ehrman, an agnostic. So I'll say, okay, well, let's take a look at Paul's epistles. In 1 Corinthians chapter 15, beginning with verse 3, excuse me. Paul says this. He says in verse 3, I gave you what I was given. And he's using technical words for passing on tradition. Now, if we believe Paul's own testimony that he was a Pharisee, we know from Josephus and others that these same terms are used by Pharisees for the passing on of tradition. This is a society where it's very possible that 90% of Jesus' audience was illiterate. And for that kind of an audience, you have to tell stories, perhaps. We call those parables. Or you have to make statements, shorter, pithier statements. And I think that was the creedal portion of the Snow White story, because critics make a big deal of short passages in the New Testament that basically answer the question of what did earliest Christian preaching consist before the very first New Testament book was written. And creeds are the answer to that question. They fill in the gap between 30-ish, the approximate death of Jesus, 30-ish and 50-ish A.D. And Paul's reporting one of these. If contemporary critical theology agrees on one thing today, it's that 1 Corinthians chapter 15, in that text, beginning with verse 3, Paul is reporting material. Let me step out here and do it this way. If this is 55 A.D., the writing of his book, and back to that table is the death of Jesus. Let's just say it that way. Paul says 55 A.D., the dates are the same, whether you're looking at critics or believers or whatever. And Paul says, verse 3, I gave you what I was given. Now let me first give you a critic's conclusion. This was not developed by believers or conservatives. It came from the critical side of town. I'm not pointing at Ken, by the way. I'm talking about my timeline here. And here's the conclusion that they come up with. I'll be glad during the Q&A or any other time to give you bibliography, names, dates, doctoral theses, whatever you want. But the leading conclusion is that Paul received this material in 35 A.D. And here's how they get this. The cross, about 30. Paul's conversion is placed at about plus 2. Paul says in Galatians chapter 1, an undoubted Pauline epistle. In fact, Bart Ehrman calls these six epistles that I've already outlined for you, he calls them undisputed Pauline epistles. There may be a person here and there, a few people, but for the most part, for an agnostic New Testament specialist like Bart Ehrman to refer to the undisputed Pauline epistles, he must not see too many people on the horizon who are going to disagree with this picture. And the idea is, here's about 30 AD. Paul meets the risen Jesus, he claims, about plus two after this event. He says 3 years later, Galatians chapter 1, 3 years later I went up to Jerusalem, 2 plus 3, 5. So we're at about 35 AD. And Paul said, when I went to Jerusalem, he said, I didn't just go up there, well, C.H. Dodd of Cambridge makes a famous statement. He said, Paul didn't go to Cambridge. Paul didn't go to Cambridge at all. He said, Paul didn't go to Jerusalem to talk about the weather. What did he do? He said, I interviewed Peter, the apostle of Jesus, and James, the brother of the Lord. And he said, they're the only two apostles I saw, and I talked to them for 15 days. In context, Paul is witnessing regarding, in the context, they're talking about the nature of the gospel. And then right afterwards, Paul says, I assure you I didn't lie about this. I talked to these fellows, and we confirmed the gospel. This is just plus five. Now, critics argue that Paul received this creedal passage. Recently, Richard Baucom, just recently retired from St. Andrews. He's living in Cambridge today. And Richard Baucom has just argued that what I'm giving to you is not some conservative, if you believe, inspiration kind of. He argues this is the consensus of modern scholarship. The consensus puts Paul's receiving this material in 35 AD. But the two men from whom Paul probably believed this material and received this material, Peter and James. Now, let me just stop there for a second. I'm not talking about Paul's own appearance. I'm talking about the two disciples talking about their appearances, Peter, James, their brother, the Lord. And he hears this here at about plus five. But these two men had the material, obviously. They had it before Paul had it. So we have to be earlier than 35. Now, creedal material is formulated. It reads in the Greek. It reads a da 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 style. Now, it doesn't rhyme like English poetry, but there's a staccato sense to it. It breaks the syntax of the sentence. Anyway, scholars are pretty well agreed where these things are. And again, there's scholars over on the other side of the equation. So, now let me stretch out this 5 years. This is 35, that's 30. Paul receives this material. It's a consensus of scholarship, according to St. Andrews, Richard Baucom. Paul receives this material plus 35. The two men from whom he received it, Peter and James, the brother of Jesus, had to have it before him. If you're going to give it to somebody, you have it first. Now, this is the date of the formulation of the creed. The events on which the creed are based has to be earlier still. And if you have two steps in between 30 AD and 35 AD, we're getting back very, very close to the events in question. How close? Am I just talking about conservative Christians? I am not. For example, let me cite one of the men on Ken's website, Gerrit Ludemann, atheist New Testament scholar in Germany. Gerrit Ludemann says, he admits this whole timeline, and he says, as well as the general dates for the epistles of Paul, what's called the authentic, the undisputed epistles, and Ludemann says, the latest that this material became a creed, the latest is 33 AD, or plus 3. He said that's the latest. In our country, we have a group of folks called the Jesus Seminar. They're extremely skeptical. In the press, they're almost synonymous with skepticism. They're the ones who throw beads in the hat, and they've rejected 80 to 90%, depending on how you count, they reject 80 to 90% of the so-called red-letter sayings of Jesus. The Jesus Seminar, not conservative, founded by Irish scholar John Dominic Cross and American scholar Marcus Borg, who's an Oxford grad, by the way, but they founded the Jesus Seminar, and they say the latest this material could be is plus 2 years after the death of Jesus. Plus 2 years. The latest contributors to this discussion are three British scholars, one right here in this city. Well, he's an American, but he's the head of a British department here, Larry Hurtado, and he said recently he has studied the subject of the deity of Christ. It's been his specialty for 35 years. And he said there's never a time when the earliest Christian preaching, there was never a time when Jesus was not preached as A, divine, and B, raised from the dead. In other words, Hurtado says the message goes back to 30 A.D. Second case, the one I mentioned, Richard Bauckham, St. Andrews. He says exactly the same. Never was a time when Jesus was preached as anything other than deity or raised. Now I'm going to tell you why this is important in a moment. Third voice is as influential a scholar as there is today in historical Jesus studies, James or Jimmy D.G. Dunn, University of Durham. And Dunn, in a recent book on Jesus Remembered, Dunn says this material becomes formally creedalized material no later than 30 A.D. Now, folks, these are scholars from some of your own universities here. In fact, I could mention Tom Wright in here, too, professor both Oxford and Cambridge. Folks, this is not an example of what kind of silly Christians are still believing this since David Hume. This is not an example of, I think it's kind of a red herring to say, what about TV preachers and Snow White? How do these people get away with teaching this kind of poppycock at Edinburgh, Durham, Oxford, Cambridge? Wouldn't they be drummed out of court if this was on the level of Snow White? You'd think so. But these fellows have written extremely influential books. Now I'm going to have to stop in a moment, but here's where I'm going. If Jesus dies here, and there never was a time when he was preached as anything other than deity, dead, and buried, what Christianity calls the gospel. If there never was a time, what that means is we don't wait decades and have somebody say, oh, look, Virgo, that must be the virgin birth, which was recently proclaimed, or go a few more decades and say, hey, I think this guy must be God. I don't want to be second best to the other religions around here, Isis and Osiris and others. Let's say he's God. Yeah, I'll say he's God. If you say he's God, yeah, from now on he's God. Oh, hey, what happens to gods? They're raised from the dead. So another 100 years later, we say he's raised from the dead. That's not the way it went. When you're doing historiography, the key to historiography, there's a bunch of rules. And actually, Ken did a good job mentioning some of the rules. Embarrassing testimony. This is just the way the New Testament scholars do it. It's the way historians write the past. And give you examples if you want. But the two most important things in historiography are the two E's, early and eyewitness. Early and eyewitness data. And what do you have if the story goes back here and you have three folks talking just 5 years later? By the way, just a few years after that, Galatians 2, Paul goes back to Jerusalem. He said, I laid before them the gospel I was preaching, of which he says the resurrection is an indispensable part. Peter's there, James, the brother of Jesus, is there, and now John's there. This is the big four. They're the most influential believers in the early church. Paul said, I set my gospel before them, and they added nothing to me. You know what that shows? It means Paul didn't make it up. It means it didn't come decades later because they're all agreeing. That's what that means. So on historical principles alone, that on the left wants to say, hey, these are the rules of engagement. They've set the rules on this because they came up with this. What we have is a report that is early. How in the ancient world, where the first biography of Alexander is plus 400 years after Alexander the Great, we have a report from 30 AD. And we have four major eyewitnesses. Folks, I'm just saying, this is only beginning tonight, but I think we're well on the basis of saying this is more than Snow White or Christian happenstance.
Okay.